Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Perhaps you don't realize it, but normal aging is not associated with dementia. Therefore, its presence implies some sort of disease process. The dementia first described by Dr. Alzheimer in 1906 remains the most common but not the only form of dementia. On this edition of Line One, my guests are neurologists Dr. Frank Ellenson and Dr. Thomas Kennedy, and their associate clinical neuropsychologist Dr. Sandra Miller. All of these individuals are from the Alaska Neurology Center here in Anchorage. What we're going to do is discuss the common dementias, their causes and symptoms, and the newest information that maybe can help us prevent their occurrence. Just a word of warning, although we are willing to take phone calls on treatment, we are not focusing specifically on treatment, more on what happens to cause dementias to develop and what's the difference between normal aging processes that may be confused for dementias and what are the true dementias. If you've got questions or comments during the next hour or so, you can reach us by calling our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. We also have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Frank, welcome back. It's the second time you've been here, I think.
I think the third time.
Thank you. Oh, really? My memory is really going already. All right. And Sandra, thank you for taking the time. And Dr. Kennedy, thank you also.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I know what neurologists do. Sandra, what does a neuropsychologist do? Particularly, what does a neuropsychologist do in a neurologic center?
So basically, neuropsychology is a specialty of clinical psychology. So we're trained as clinical psychologists first. And then in the specialty track, you focus on brain behavior relationships in terms of things, especially like cognition, you know, thinking, memory, and so forth, and how that's related to neuroanatomy and a variety of neurological disorders.
And I assume you are doing some testing to help tease out where people might be on the spectrum of difficulties related to dementia.
That's correct. Testing is a big part of what we do. there are tests that have been designed and we call it normed on large samples of people. So we know what healthy adults or kids, depending on what you're doing, we know what the normal range is. And so oftentimes when you have someone coming in for the first time, you're doing the testing and you're comparing them to the broader sample, looking for strengths and weaknesses.
And when you say they're normalized by age. I assume there's various differences in cognitive function that you can test at different ages.
That's correct. So probably the most common things we control for statistically is, is age and gender. Those are the most common. And when you have a big enough sample, you can stratify it down even to control for different levels of education.
So my wife would be interested. There's a difference between gender and how we do cognitively?
That's a whole nother topic, I think.
I'm always more forgetful, and I always have to have my wife figure out what how to fix things correctly. So it's a home joke, so to speak. Well, let's get listeners on the same page with us a little bit. If you don't mind, maybe, Frank, I'll ask you to tell us about the structure down. Let's talk about neurons, what's in the brain. I'm interested in how information is taken in, processed, what's memory, all those simple answers about things.
Absolutely. So generally speaking, we can break down the anatomy of the brain in many, many different ways, but we have all heard of, at least in reference to fiction or science that you may have read, the gray matter versus the white matter. The gray matter is the outer surface of the brain where the cell bodies for neurons reside for the most part. And the white matter are connections between the neurons projecting either into the spinal cord or to other neurons in the brain. In addition, there's four or five times as many supporting cells that help to add structure to the brain and clear antigens or metabolic byproducts and support the function of the neurons. So the neuron is a relatively large cell. It the length of a neuron could actually be several feet as it stretches from your brain down into the lower parts of your spinal cord. The neurons act electrically. Small electric current will discharge down the length of the neuron so that it could then, what we say, synapse to another neuron and cause the transmission of information. So when you are touched on your leg, the stimulus is then transmitted from the neuron in your leg up through the spinal cord and finally into the brain, and it'll end synapse in the cortex of the brain, allowing you to understand you've been touched on the leg. In a similar fashion, neurons will form circuits between, can be dozens or hundreds of other neuron cells to store information, and that can be an experience, a memory, something you learned, a smell you experienced, a taste you had. And then you're able to recall that experience by activating that circuit again.
I know this is kind of a loaded question. I've been fascinated since medical school when I had the opportunity to try to figure out why mice in a maze, if we taught them how to go through the maze, if you gave them a drug back in the 70s called puramycin, which was an antibiotic that affected RNA synthesis, they couldn't figure it out after you'd given them that. What is memory and how is memory stored? And my understanding why it's a loaded question is we still don't understand that.
That's probably very, very true. What I said earlier, about memories being stored in neurons, I think that's a very obvious and very true statement, but exactly how that information is stored at a cellular level, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not certain that it's clear. I think that you drugged your mice back in the 70s
right.
In the same way that someone could become intoxicated with drugs or alcohol mm-hmm. and prevented them from functioning normally.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's move on to the question about dementia. And Dr. Kennedy, I'm going to ask you what we mean by the term dementia then.
There are a number of different concepts or different parts of the dementia. Generally, it's a loss of ability to take care of your daily activities, affects memory, but also other, as we call it, domains. So memory is the big issue that people consider with Alzheimer's or other dementia. But the other domains, whether it's executive function, planning, whether it's visual, spatial, whether it's auditory, whether it's just kind of getting the brain in gear. So a lot of different parts to it. Mm-hmm. And just to kind of add on what Frank was saying, I was thinking there are different the brain has the neurons and then the supporting structure.
Right.
They're different. It's almost like a computer, and there are different parts. They're all neurons, but they have different job descriptions, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. if the hippocampus is in charge of memory or helps, all of the different parts are necessary, just like on a computer. So mm-hmm. I guess the more we learn about the computer, mm-hmm. the more we appreciate the brain, too.
Yeah. Right. And that also brings up in my mind, I've done a couple of programs where we've talked about learning, and particularly as it relates to sports. And it's my understanding now that the myelin sheath that's covering these neurons, with more practice, with more stimulation, that myelin actually gets a little bit thicker, a little bit heavier, and that improves transmission and accuracy and speed. And so that gets to these circuits that are in the brain, that there are repetitive actions cause real physical changes in the brain so that there's circuits. So that a pianist may have a certain area of their brain that's different than someone who is not a pianist. Am I overstating the point here?
Well, I think that's probably accurate. As you learn, you integrate those circuits, and you mm-hmm. first you form the circuits, and then you reinforce mm-hmm. The circuits. And you might stop doing that activity for a few years, but you're able to relearn it quicker than you learned it in the mm-hmm. first place. So those neuronal circuits still remain.
One more point about the brain and learning that's become important, particularly in pediatrics, and I kind of want to say it and ask you as neurologists whether it's true, and that is that if we think about it, the brain is exquisitely good at learning. It is not very good at unlearning. So that you learn how to ride a bike, but nobody in this room can tell me how to unlearn how to ride a bike. And that becomes important in pediatrics because we're now recognizing that the first several years of life are very, very important for setting up long-term consequences throughout life as that brain is forming for the first particular time. Does that make sense to you guys as neurologists and neuropsychologists, by the way?
Well, I think so. I can't tell you how to unlearn how to ride a bike, but unfortunately, dementia is probably a good topic to discuss that because people do unlearn skills, and the first thing may be simply being forgetful and not remembering the conversation you had with a spouse or a friend. But later on, unfortunately, can be as severe as forgetting to eat or knowing how to change your clothes or where you live or even how to speak. So that deterioration is unlearning in a sense.
Is that normal?
It's a part of dementia, so no, it's a disease process,
right? Okay.
Normal adults should not have those kind of difficulties I described.
Right. Well, what's happening then that causes the loss of memory? Dr. Kennedy, are the loss of executive function or the loss or change of emotions and so forth, as you described?
As mentioned, there are different parts of the brain have different job descriptions. The frontal lobe has executive function. I could defer to Dr. Mitchell, but the different parts of the brain have different job descriptions. Mm-hmm. So if it's memory, if it's executive functions or judgment, it could be the frontal lobe. If it's the memory and recording, sort of the recorder part of the brain in the hippocampus. So different parts that are damaged could see the deficit manifest in different situations in different domains.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Mitchell, would you answer that in any other way?
And are you, just so that I understand the question, you're asking how physiologically does that happen that you lose?
Yeah. What is there a pathology that's going on that causes that loss of memory, which, as we have defined, as I understand it, is not normal. It's not a normal process.
Right. Dementia is an acquired loss of knowledge that you had before compared to a developmental problem where it's more of a front-end problem. I think getting back to what both of my colleagues have said about circuitry, different circuits, and I think that's what Tom was getting at too, that, the frontal lobes are wired in certain ways. And so when you have a loss of function, it really points you towards specific neuroanatomy. So in the case of Alzheimer's disease, you're talking about loss of cells and around the hippocampus and the entorhinal cortex, which is involved in memory consolidation. So when you start seeing memory problems and what we know from the pathology studies, that's usually where you first start to see some of the pathology that's related to Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Let me take just a quick second to remind listeners, once again, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is originating on Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guests today are two neurologists and a neuropsychologist, and we're talking about dementias. We're trying to understand what's different about the brains in people with dementia and those that do not, what's normal aging processes and how that differs from dementia, and maybe a little bit more detail about what's happening with Alzheimer's disease. And if time allows, our questions come in, we'll talk a little bit about treatment. But the basic premise here today is to try to understand what's happening with the brain in dementias. If you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. One thing I should mention also at the beginning of the program is the source of the idea for this program for me was a 5-part series on dementia from the New York Academy of Sciences podcast. It was called Dementia Decoded. There was a later 6th program brought on that came on, which asked the question whether diet or other environmental actions might prevent dementia. For anybody who's interested in hearing those six podcasts, the link is on our website at alaskapublic.org. Or you could look up the New York Academy of Sciences and just put in the word dementia. I'm sure that'll come up. So thinking back when I was listening to those podcasts, one of the things that caught my attention and the reason I was asking about the differences is it struck me that the point was in dementia, there's actually cell loss. There's death. And that's different than normal aging, where we may forget where our keys are, but eventually we can figure out how to find those keys or do something about it because there's not cell loss. Is that true? Does that make sense?
Yes, that is very true.
So a big difference between dementias and normal aging is there's actually death of neurons or supporting cells or both.
Primarily, we're speaking of the neurons. Those are the ones who, especially with dementia or normal aging, allow us to remember and to act. The structural cells are important too, but in the case of dementia, we're speaking of the neurons, the cells that allow us to do what we need to do.
All right. And maybe one more question about structure before we move on. I want to ask a little bit about the different kinds of dementias, not just Alzheimer's. But we talked, Frank, you mentioned briefly about a synapse. So there's an electrical conduction system that's shooting information down a neuron, and then that information transfer from one neuron to another, not electrically, but by another mechanism.
Chemically.
Yeah.
So an axon will release a neurochemical. There's many of these that cause the transmission. And when the chemical is received at the end of the other neuron, at what we call the dendrite, that nerve will be stimulated by that chemical transmission and very likely will propagate another nerve impulse down its axon to an end organ, perhaps, or to another neuron.
And many of these neurons are kind of actually physically connected through synapses with each other, forming these circuits and various and other and sundry, very extremely complex interaction and interplay.
Correct. Also, the synapses, we were talking earlier about the reverse, to something to the extent of reversible versus non-reversible memory loss and dementia. When there's loss of the nerve cells, the neurons, they don't regenerate. The loss of the synapses, those can actually recover. So a number of disorders, when there's a problem with the synapse, those can regenerate or recover or repair. So that's another thing to consider with the memory problems.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that. So the whole neuron, if it's damaged, that's it. But if there's some particular process that damages just the synapse, that can recur and regenerate, so to speak.
Right, but also the brain has an amazing plasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
some of the brain cells have died off, the brain naturally can redirect it. There can be detours around some cells. So these detours can take over the function of the brain remarkably well. That happens with the dementias, happens with stroke, any other injury or insult to the brain. There can be recovery through the detours.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. That's something that I did not think about before the program, and that's this whole issue of plasticity. Sandra, you want to entertain it. So even though there may be loss of neurons, there may be apparent recovery because of the plasticity of other parts of the brain taking up job that other neurons used to do. Is that what we're saying?
The point I was wanting to make is that this neuroplasticity is happening all the time. So your brain and these neurons are constantly making and breaking new connections all the time. And that's, I guess, part of the learning process. You know, for every experience that you have, you're making new connections. And that's part of learning. I guess that was mainly the point that I wanted to make. When we're talking about neuroplasticity, it's not something that just happens when a cell stops functioning correctly. It's happening all the time.
Why would that be going on? So what I heard you said, or what I interpreted, is during our lifetime, during certain periods of our life, we may be deciding we're not going to use this particular synapse very often, and we're going to use another synapse because of environmental stimuli. Is that what we're saying, or is that too simplistic?
I'm not exactly sure how to communicate that. Basically, the brain is constantly in a state of development. It's mm-hmm. constantly changing. So when you have a new experience or you are practicing playing the piano over mm-hmm. the expert learning that you were talking about earlier, right. as you have more and more of those experiences, you're making more and more connections. The dendrites are branching out, and they're making more connections with other cells.
Okay. All right. This is particularly true early in life, it seems to me. I know there seems to be critical periods in infant's development. Again, I'm bringing myself back to pediatrics where I'm a little bit more familiar. If a baby is not have their vision stimulated over a period of time, eventually, no matter what you do, it's hard to bring that vision to bear, because my understanding is the brain says, now why in the world are my body waste energy on certain neurons that are not being stimulated? So I'm just going to prune those things away. Is that kind of that's a part of the process that may be more important earlier in life? Why is plasticity easier to do earlier in life compared to later in life?
Well, I think we'd probably all agree on that. Part of what you were bringing up with a child losing vision from lack of stimulus, I think, is a developmental issue. Our brains don't come out fully developed. And in fact, I like to mention to my teenager that his frontal lobes aren't developed, and that's why he needs a parent right now.
Right.
If you don't stimulate the different portions of your brain, the language, the area of the cortex responsible for learning language, it becomes harder to learn a language. And as a pediatrician, you know that children don't see much at all when they're first born, and then they're learning for the first few months of their lives to have their eyes tracked together. And later to differentiate mom from other people. And so without that, that's a developmental issue, I think. Mm-hmm. And to speak to the plasticity, I think Sandra said it well. What I would add to what Tom said is I don't feel that we've established well that other parts of the brain can take over for different anatomic areas. I think there's a tremendous redundancy built into our brain, and many of the nearby cells have similar functions. So after a stroke, I always tell patients, you're going to get better from where you are today, but the question is it 50%, 75%, 100% better? That sometimes depends on the location and the severity of the stroke. Certain areas don't recover well. Back to vision, the visual cortex is so highly specialized, and the cells nearby don't have a similar function. So if you have a stroke in your visual cortex, it usually doesn't recover well. But there is, as Sandra was saying, constant learning, the nerves that make those memories, that make those motor circuits are constantly refining their skills. And as another example, my son played the clarinet. I picked it up. I used to play clarinet, and I couldn't make a sound out of it. I'm certain with a couple dozen lessons, I could learn to make a sound out of it again. But those circuits are in such disuse that they've probably been used to do something that I'm better at now than I used to be.
So I want to make sure I understand your suggestion of plasticity. It seems like it's subtle but important. It's not that plasticity means that any part of the brain can begin to do the function of a lost part of the brain. It's that certain neurons have already pre-programmed, pre-genetically, have the ability to take up certain functions if those functions are needed. But it's not true that all neurons could take up all functions that were lost.
I think that's pretty well said.
Right. Yeah. I hadn't realized that. Okay. And you use the occipital cortex, which is our visual cortex, because it's so highly specialized that there are very few other cells in the brain that might have that ability. And so when we lose that, it's hard to make up for it.
Yes.
Interesting. I was not aware of that. Okay. What I do want to do is go on now and talk about some of the different dementias, but I think this would be a good time for me to just take our halfway break, and then we'll come back and start talking about different causes of these problems and the different kinds of dementias. So let me remind listeners, once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a 1-minute break, and then we'll continue our conversation on dementia with neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson and Dr. Thomas Kennedy and neuropsychologist Dr. Sandra Miller. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guests today are neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson and Dr. Thomas Kennedy and neuropsychologist Dr. Sandra Mitchell. And I've just noticed that she corrected me and I have it written wrong here in front of me, although I have it right in another part. Sandra, my apologies for that.
No problem.
All of these individuals are from the Alaska Neurology Center here in Anchorage. Our topic is the dementias, especially Alzheimer's disease. And unfortunately for this program, the emphasis is going to be primarily not on treatment, but rather on causation, symptoms, and the disease processes. You can email your questions, however, to line1@alaskapublic.org. Our call, our local number, which is 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, if you're listening between 8 and 9 on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be available to answer your questions and emails. Dr. Kennedy, let's talk about the dementias and the causes of the dementia. We'll get to Alzheimer's, but there are other dementias. It's my understanding Alzheimer's is the most common dementia, but what are the other dementias that are well recognized? And we don't have to get really esoteric, the most common ones. And what are the causes of those particular dementias?
Good question. The Alzheimer's is one of the neurodegenerative causes. And it seems to me sometimes neurologic problems are almost pre-programmed. So they might, something that's genetic or non-genetic, the brain is pre-programmed, and at a certain age, things start deteriorating. But you're right, Alzheimer's is the most common. There are other causes of neurodegenerative problems, such as Parkinson's, which can cause dementia, Lewy body disease, and there's some other technicalities on the neurodegenerative problems. Another major category is the vascular dementia, and there could be a single stroke or what we call multi-infarct dementia or vascular dementia, where the blood vessels are the primary problem. Then there's other causes such as nutritional, which I'm especially interested in. And then there's other causes that can be look-alike, can look like dementia, but they're treatable. For example, depression. Maybe someone's taking medication can look like dementia. Adverse response to the medication can look like a dementia. So there are a number of different causes, but the neurodegenerative and the vascular are the main causes. I might add also that it helps a lot to try to distinguish the different causes because there's different treatments. Even something as simple as, so many people now have problems with cholesterol and blood pressure. My feeling is those are very important. And diabetes, the most common disorders, those can affect the blood vessels. The sugar, as I mentioned with diabetes, sugar can affect the brain and the nutrition. And so addressing something as simple as taking care of your general health is very important to preventing the dementia, especially the blood. My personal feelings really emphasize heavy emphasis on the blood pressure control, blood sugar control, and the cholesterol, so to keep the blood vessels healthy.
So what I'm hearing you say is there are some vascular problems, there's some nutritional problems, and so forth. But what I'm hearing you say, if you're telling me right, is exercise, eat well, control your blood pressure, don't get diabetes, don't get overweight. Those are the basic preventative efforts that probably have as much bang as for the buck as anything we can do right now.
That's very important, yes. Their medications have a limited response, but trying to head it off before it develops is even more important. And some of the other things, like we were talking before the program about exercise. Exercise is the way it affects the blood vessels, the circulation, the blood sugar. All those things are very important for prevention. Like you say, just more or less healthy lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. And I'd add sleep in there, Dad. A good point. Good healthy sleep.
Yeah.
I would also add social engagement and stimulating your brain to keep doing new things, keep learning, lifelong learning.
Yeah, it always gets back to the basics, doesn't it? Exercise, socialization.
Learning new things.
Eating healthy.
Eating healthy. Yeah. On the contrary, or the further along, that once you start into the, once you have the injury, once you have the insult, Dr. Kennedy, let me ask you, since you're very interested in this, can, hopefully you can, hopefully once this vascular insult, nutritional insult, whatever, may have started us down the road to one of the dementias, can changing the quality of life, helping socialization, all these things begin to have some improvement? Or does it just seem to hold things in check where they are if we've truly lost neurons because of this process?
A good question. What you want to do is get all of the lifestyle changes are very important. Like you say, if the disorder has already started, can we either keep it constant or can we improve it or reverse it? Sometimes controlling the blood pressure, controlling the blood sugar, a lot of things can actually reverse certain dementias. So it's important to identify the type of dementia and address the optimal treatment. So there, to give people hope, if there's a diagnosis of dementia or mild cognitive impairment, if it's due to poor blood sugar control or lack of socialization or lack of learning, or one of my favorite treatment is exercise. And getting the exercise can really help regenerate the brain cells or the cells too. Mm-hmm. And like we were talking earlier, the plasticity or helping the cells that have not been active help get those more active too.
That, if I could, I'd ask your listeners not to wait until they start to have dementia before enacting these healthy changes. Most of the studies show that what you do in your midlife, your 30s, 40s, and 50s, play the biggest role in maybe changing the likelihood of developing dementia older. If you wait until you're 60 and you're destined to have dementia, probably the pathologic changes have already begun. And we have no proof that I'm aware of now that enacting changes once the pathology has begun, that you'll be able to reverse the pathology or lower the risk of having dementia. So it's really a lifestyle choice that you have to make when you're young and middle age if you want to make these things happen to lower your risk when you're older.
We've all heard, I assume by now, that exercise is good for cardiovascular health. It may be good for weight. But what I'm hearing you say is it's good for mental function. It's good for cognitive function. It's good for your brain.
Yes.
Got an email, and this is from a lady who says her husband was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2008, 7 years ago. I realized for several years prior to that something was wrong. I just figured he was getting old. He's now 80, so 7 years ago he would have been 73 when he was diagnosed. His condition continued to worsen. None of the medications seemed to slow progression. At his doctor's suggestion, I placed him in assisted living last fall, and his condition continues to worsen. He worked around large trucks and heavy equipment his whole life, both as a mechanic and as an operator. I was wondering if there can be any correlation between continuous exposure to diesel, maybe heavy metal poisoning. She used the word metal poisoning. I'm thinking heavy metal poisoning. and his condition. He doesn't seem to fit any particular forms of Alzheimer's. I'm not sure what she means by that. Maybe you guys can help me. When working on his equipment, he never wore a mask and used gasoline to help clean his hands. This went on for over 45 years. So this is a question about Alzheimer's and environmental or work exposures, particularly heavy metals, diesel fumes.
I don't think we know the answer to that question. I would say it's certainly a possibility, and heavy metal toxicity can cause cognitive impairment. It probably would manifest with some testing that Sandra could do that maybe could differentiate that from ordinary Alzheimer's disease. But as listening to those podcasts that you mentioned from the New York Academy of Science, lots of different things may influence your likelihood of developing dementia, in particular Alzheimer's disease. So I guess I wouldn't rule that out. And nowadays, I think there's many more safety precautions in place for people working around toxic potential exposures.
Mm-hmm. Tom, would you agree at this particular time, we, at least those of us here, know of no association between heavy metal diesel exposures and Alzheimer's disease or any dementia?
I would agree on that. The say, exhaust fumes or toxic fumes, I would say that we're not familiar with that, not, at least not as a cause of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Other, like Frank was saying, there could be some heavy metals or metal poisoning. If it's lead or arsenic or mercury, certain things can play a role possibly.
We're beginning to get some phone calls, and I would like to make it clear to listeners that when we talk about various dementias, I look at different dementias as like different people. They have a different personality, they have a different timing, they have a different way of being recognized. And so that is what neurologists are doing, is they're looking at people along with a neuropsychologist and trying to figure out, is this dementia, but also based on history and exposures and so forth, what the cause of that dementia is, because, as Dr. Kennedy has mentioned earlier, the treatments may differ. All right. So what's different between vascular dementia or nutritional dementia versus Alzheimer's disease? Or how does Alzheimer's stand itself out? When you see somebody, what is it that makes you say, boy, this is probably Alzheimer's versus some other form of dementia? I guess is another way of saying that question.
I'll tackle it.
Sure.
So one of the things that we do from a neuropsychological standpoint is trying to tease apart the different kinds of neurocognitive profiles that we see. Mm. So take the two most common kinds of dementia, vascular. And when I'm talking about vascular, I think just for the similarity, we're going to talk about small vessel vascular disease, which isn't a Frank stroke, and then comparing that to Alzheimer's, because both of those do tend to have not what we used to think of with multi-infarct with that stepwise decline, but they both kind of have a slow and gradual decline, and from the outside, they can look very similar. But on testing, what we're able to do is break down the memory profile so that we know exactly where in that very complex process the dysfunction is happening. So for instance, in Alzheimer's disease, what we're really talking about is rapid forgetting. So some of the complaints that usually bring people in is that they're asking the same questions or repeating the same stories over and over in the course of a day, or losing their way in familiar surroundings, or forgetting appointments, forgetting to eat, forgetting to take their medications. Whereas in a more of the subcortical kinds of cognitive dysfunction, like small vessel vascular disease or Parkinson's disease, you tend to see what you alluded to earlier, which is that difficulty with retrieval. So the information is in there, but their search strategy isn't helping them retrieve the information when they need it. And so we can tease that apart in testing. I think that answers your question.
The disease processes leave a telltale signature of what's going on, and we've now gotten to the point with neuropsychologists that we can pretty much figure that out by the signature that the disease processors are leaving. That's what I'm hearing being said here. And age is one, maybe sex is another one, but particularly the parts of the brains that are being affected and the timing of that those effects.
Right. And I mean, frontotemporal dementia, I think, is number three in the list of causes. So obviously the pathology there is either happening in the frontal lobes or the temporal lobes or both, versus in Alzheimer's disease where you're seeing sort of an onset in the medial temporal lobe.
Again, we're getting a lot of questions, and I want to get to the questions, but I also have to talk about Alzheimer's. What do we know is going on pathologically in Alzheimer's that appears to be somewhat of a signature of this disease process?
There's several parts. The things that are talked about most are the beta amyloid, which is outside of the nerve cells, then the neurofibrillary tangles, which are inside the cells, and then the cell death. So the cell death is kind of the final common pathway. And there's been a controversy for a number of years about the amyloid, the tangles, and the cell death. If they all come on a parallel course, or if one causes the other, or if there's a cascade. So don't think the final verdict is in on that. But we do know about the neurofibrillary tangles, which is there to a certain extent, the neurofibrillary tangles can be normal. Some of them can be helpful to support the brain or the supportive structure. With the amyloid, a lot of people can have amyloid but not have dementia. So that there might be some, a usefulness to the amyloid, but people can have some amyloid build up for 20 years and still not have any dementia. So those are the main factors that we see with the Alzheimer's. And the other thing would be along the same corollary, the same lines, we talked about the axons and dendrites. The dendrites are like branches on a tree, and they can gradually get pruned away. So there are loss of dendrites throughout the brain, and that gradual loss of the branches is contributing to.
So one of so what I'm hearing you say is we know for a fact that anatomically that people with Alzheimer's disease have these structural changes in neuronal death, but what gets complicated is some normal people may have some of these things. They may take various amounts of time to develop, and some people who have some of them never have these problems. And we don't know if these are the consequence of an illness causing Alzheimer's or they are the driving factor. And so it makes it, we're still struggling with that. And a lot of the newest treatments are designed, as my understanding is, to kind of affect that amyloid, but maybe there's some evidence it's slowing the process, but it's these aren't big bangs for our bucks yet.
Right. The other thing I was thinking of was that the amyloid and the tau, the neurofibrillary tangles are important. We know about those, but the other thing it's kind of a two-pronged comment. One is that inflammation may be playing a role, and inflammation might be what sets it off, and other illnesses, chronic illnesses, can set it off, which is another reason, like you mentioned earlier, to take care of, practice a healthy lifestyle, because if the diabetes gets a little out of control, the cholesterol's up, there's inflammation that we know about, a lot of markers in the body that are inflammatory markers, and who knows, maybe those are contributing to it. And that's something we could also try to minimize.
Yeah, so one of the arguments is, okay, so people have the amyloid beta buildup and they have neurofibrillary tangles, but they never develop inflammation for whatever reason, and they never develop Alzheimer's disease. Is that part of the argument? The argument then is it's inflammation that causes Alzheimer's disease.
Right. We just don't know.
We don't understand
the answer.
We don't
correct.
Know.
And not to be too basic, we're also living a lot longer than we used
absolutely.
To.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Maybe we never lived long enough for the fallout of those inflammatory processes to make a difference.
At the start of these podcasts, I was taken aback. In 1900, 115 years ago, the average lifespan was 45 in the United States. You know, it's now in the 70s. And so inevitably, we're seeing more cancer and we're seeing more things related to just aging processes. But we don't know, back to these changes, we don't know why the amyloid's forming. We don't know why the neurofibrillary tangles are forming. We don't know how to necessarily stop them from forming either. It could
absolutely.
Could be nutritional, could be lack of exercise. We don't know. It doesn't appear to be genetics, which is very interesting in some of the stuff I was reading.
Well, there are genes,
yeah.
Maybe about 20% or fewer that we would consider a genetic type of Alzheimer's disease. But you're right, the majority are what we call sporadic.
Yeah.
And lots of patients will talk to me maybe about a different reason, but then just say, hey, by the way, my mom had Alzheimer's disease. Am I at risk? And one of the first questions I ask is, well, how old was your mom when she became symptomatic? So usually if the Alzheimer's disease started in a patient after age 60, it's considered a normal adult late age onset Alzheimer's disease, whereas if it starts in the 30s, 40s, or 50s, then you start to be concerned about a genetic cause, which would then influence the risk of the next generation.
Mm-hmm. So it's that early onset that has a much, much stronger genetic predisposition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Brenda, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I have a question. I have been listening for about 15 minutes, so I apologize if this was already addressed. What I wanted to know is I had two friends, and it's just my own observation that they're people that, you know, took very good care of themselves, very healthy, good lifestyle habits, and, you know, very good lives, but then experienced some very traumatic events in their lives, like life-altering traumatic events. And then they were only in their late 40s, early 50s, both people like 10 years apart, started suffering this decline and really developed Alzheimer's very extensively, you know, in their 50s. And is stressful events considered a risk factor, you know, having that sort of thing?
I'm going to ask a neuropsychologist to answer that question.
So, I mean, that's a really complicated question. I do think I don't know of any direct relationship between traumatic events causing Alzheimer's disease. So let's just say that. But of course, like we discussed earlier, there's lots of different causes of dementia, and especially to have an onset so early, that tends to point you in a slightly different direction, at least in terms of prevalence rates. But what I tell a lot of my patients, because I see the worried well and other folks who come in, when you have a traumatic event, it takes up a lot of space. It takes up a lot of your cognitive capacity. And so it's a limited amount that you have. Now, in terms of this becoming neurodegenerative, you know, without knowing more of the details, I really couldn't possibly say, but I would say that there's not a direct relationship to a psychologically traumatic event and developing a disease process such as Alzheimer's.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thinking about other causes, what about alcohol? Alcohol seems to cause neurologic problems, and I'm maybe wrong, but I'm saying it causes dementia as well. Does it cause dementia? Does overdrinking cause dementia? And if you were developing dementia, what happens if you were to stop drinking alcohol?
I think it does. It can be a risk factor, and we didn't mention too much about genetic predisposition, but there's certain genetic things I think Frank was alluding to. There's APOE4 that can be a genetic risk factor. Not everyone with APOE4 develops Alzheimer's, but if you're at risk, an increased risk, then the alcohol or other brain insults could be more, that person could be more susceptible. So I wouldn't recommend doing a study of giving everybody high dose of alcohol for years, but some people with heavy alcohol use can become demented and some don't. So,
Is memory loss part of typical alcohol abuse?
Abuse, I would think so. Chronic alcohol mm-hmm. abuse does lead to memory and cognitive impairment.
Okay.
And also another factor is a lot of times people drink heavily, they're not eating very mm-hmm. well.
Yeah, you get some nutritional issues related to that.
Definitely yeah. Vitamins, vitamin D, vitamin B12, B-complex right. vitamins are all mm-hmm. very important, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the problems in medicine is that there's often one factor seems primary, but then that leads to other factors that are what we call cofactors or coincidental factors that also can complicate, add to, or affect the consequences of a problem. I was just thinking about stress. People under stress may act differently. They may do different things. They may eat differently. They may have hypertension. They may have tachycardia. So there's a lot of factors that might lead to some predisposition to risk just based on long periods of stress. Got another question, maybe a little bit off the wall, but maybe not. It said this is an email. My father died of normal pressure hydrocephalus. I noticed his decline started about 10 years before his death. Could you explain this, if this condition was the cause, I guess, of his mental decline 10 years before the death, and what's happening in that situation?
Well, normal pressure hydrocephalus is a condition characterized by, well, the word hydrocephalus, which means increased fluid spaces in the brain. The CSF space is enlarged, but at the same time, the pressure in the skull is normal. Oftentimes, when hydrocephalus develops, it's because there's been an obstruction of the spinal fluid outflow from the brain, and the pressure will increase. So this is a distinction. That disease is characterized by cognitive impairment, gait impairment, and incontinence. Those are typically the three characteristics, plus excluding other causes for any of those three conditions. Usually an MRI or a CAT scan can be very helpful in pointing towards that diagnosis, followed by a lumbar puncture, a spinal fluid tap, to evaluate whether the patient will improve if you remove some spinal fluid. It's impossible for me to say if that emailer's relative died because of that, but those are the three characteristics that we use to diagnose normal pressure hydrocephalus and the typical diagnostic pathway to make certain of the diagnosis.
Okay. Thanks for addressing that. I have another caller. Brent, you're on line one.
Yes. I recently had an experience with a couple of relatives who one had was 89 and paraplegic and developed a urinary tract infection and became very different personality-wise and became very confused. I mentioned the UTI because it was something called they called VRE, which was not treatable with most antibiotics. And they, over time, his condition changed drastically, and this was very surprising to us because he'd been a very sharp person, very with it, and able to carry on good technical conversations until just a few months before his death. And as he was approaching death, this UTI occurred, and his personality and ability to kind of link things together changed. I guess a question I have are certain sorts of dementia treatable, and could one recover from those if one could deal with them, you know, early enough?
We'll address that. I think it's interesting. Let me ask one question that might be on the neurologist's minds. Is that when he developed the urinary tract infection, did he get quite sick? Was he, for example, septic? Did he really have shock or any other significant problems related to that infection?
It wasn't immediately obvious. He had pneumonia concurrently with that, and that was treated with other antibiotics.
Okay.
And he did recover from the pneumonia, but they, in essence, stopped treating for both of them. But he'd had pneumonia before. He never had this this confusion that went along with coincident with this other diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so I guess my question is, are these things treatable sometimes?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, many comments I can make about that situation. One is I don't suspect a situation of dementia being caused by a urinary tract infection. On the other hand, older adults who may appear to be functioning well might, under closer inspection, have pre-existing cognitive impairment, and in some cases are either covering it up very well or their family members have taken over some of their activities for them, and so that it's not as obvious. But a lot of older folks who develop pneumonia or urinary tract infection become delirious, which is a reversible cognitive impairment associated with illness or sleep deprivation or medications or drug exposures. So that certainly is a possibility, although if this was a simple delirium, he probably would have recovered after treatment. And I think Thad was asking questions about perhaps there was other downstream effects of the two infections he has that may have caused more of a persistent brain problem. Perhaps there were strokes involved or other significant illnesses that went on at that time. So I'm not able to give you an answer to tell you what happened with your relative, but at the same time, this is not at all an unfamiliar situation that we see in the hospital frequently.
And maybe calling it dementia might not be the proper connection. It might be some delusion caused by other infections or activity.
Right. It could have been a secondary delirium as opposed to dementia, which is defined as a structural brain pathology.
Okay. Thank you for answering.
Yep. You're welcome. Great question. Thank you. So we got about 2.5-3 minutes left. Does Dr. Kennedy, let me ask you, is diet going to solve all of our Alzheimer's disease? If we eat better, we don't have diabetes, we're not overweight, we exercise, what's your thoughts?
I think it's a mixed bag because if people have one of the high-risk genes or high-risk genetic problems, then a poor lifestyle will make it come out more. Mm-hmm. If they have the high-risk genes and then they follow a healthy lifestyle, they can certainly minimize it. We don't always know how if we have good genes or bad genes, so it's to everyone's advantage to follow a healthy lifestyle. There are certain things that just for general principles, we didn't talk about very much. We mentioned nutrition. We just called that as a general term. But vitamin B12 deficiency can cause a dementia in its own right. Vitamin D3, vitamin D is very important. Those are two of the most important vitamins for nutrition. So those are worthwhile taking. I recommend that for almost all of my patients. Just if you could do anything to help anyone for the quality of life, those are a couple things I'd recommend.
Dr. Mitchell, I came up in medicine as an epidemiologist, and your point about as we're getting older, things happen. It made me wonder, even in 1900, there were people living to the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Have you ever read or heard any evidence that elderly people who made it to 70 and 80 before the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the rate of dementia was any different? You know, so the question is it our environment now that's causing adding on to our dementias, or was it already present before? Or not, you know, you understand my point.
I do.
And obviously the answer is, we don't know.
I don't think we know that. Yeah. Again, people are living longer. You know, you have more time to build up pathology. Mm-hmm. You can have more problems. I mean, even when we see Alzheimer's disease, it's very common to have comorbid vascular disease at the same time. You know, these things don't happen in a vacuum. But in terms of knowing whether the rates have increased over time, I don't know that, and I don't think there's any evidence to support that.
With Alzheimer's disease, there can be emotional changes that are is that characteristic more characteristic of Alzheimer's disease than behaviors than other kinds of dementias, or that's not much of a clue?
No, I don't think it's a clue. In fact, I think early on in Alzheimer's disease, your personality tends to be very similar as to how you've been throughout your life, whereas some other dementias, personality starts to change sooner, and that can be a clue for the clinician to help make the diagnosis.
All right. My thanks to you guys. This is a little bit of a deeper program. I like sometimes to have the listeners realize that it's not as simple as it may seem to everybody and that there's a lot more depth to some of these issues, and hopefully we got that point across today. My guests were neurologist Dr. Frank Ellenson and Dr. Thomas Kennedy and neuropsychologist Dr. Sandra Mitchell, all from the Alaska Neurology Center. Next week, we return. I would say that, remind you that it's estimated that 1 in 100 children in the U.S. may have fetal alcohol spectrum associated disorders. They may have lifelong consequences. So next Monday at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing that on Alaska on Line 1, Your Health Connection. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron, audio engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Well,
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.